You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. At age 43, Tampa Bay Buccaneers quarterback Tom Brady won his seventh Super Bowl on Sunday. That's old in football years. Coming up, our guest says it's time to rethink how we look at age and what we expect of ourselves as we get older. Now, Wisconsin's initial vaccine rollout was criticized for being one of the slowest in the nation. But over the last couple of weeks, the supply and delivery of vaccines has improved. As of yesterday, the state's seven-day average rate of vaccination stood at over 6,000 shots per million residents per day. That's the highest rate in the country. And next week, the Department of Health Services will start opening community vaccination clinics, the first in Rock County. But some local officials and health providers say there are still logistical problems, especially knowing how many doses to expect from the state and, in turn, how many appointments to schedule. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you gotten one or both rounds of the vaccine? What's your experience like getting an appointment, going in for a shot? If you work in healthcare, getting people vaccinated, what's gone well so far? What has gone less well? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Ajay Sethi is an epidemiologist and associate professor of population health sciences at the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. Ajay, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you, Rob. I'm glad to be here.
Well, a vaccine rollout in general can be pretty complicated. What are your thoughts on how it's been going in Wisconsin over the last couple few weeks?
Well, initially, it certainly got off to a slow start, but you know, those are growing pains that I think every state was experiencing, or at least most of them. The last couple of weeks have been good, and Wisconsin is doing quite well.
Now, part of the problem lately, it seems that we see reports of people having appointments that then get canceled. If I'm a healthcare provider, I don't know necessarily how much vaccine I'm going to get from the state this week. And it sounds like if I'm the state, I don't know how many vaccines I'm going to get from the federal government and from companies this week. Can you talk about some of the just the logistical challenges of knowing how many vaccines you're going to have and how many people you need to get into the office?
Yeah, and to add to that, the federal government sometimes is not sure what's in the pipeline coming in from the manufacturers. So everybody has to be patient, and this is sort of the phase that we're in. You know, down at the ground level where vaccines are being administered, supply is the issue. You know, the vaccinators make requests of the state. Those requests are not being met because there are supply issues. And so when a health system makes appointments, you know, people who have those appointments, you know, should be expecting potentially some reschedules because the supply simply didn't come in. And it's frustrating, but it's sort of the phase that we're in right now.
Taking a much wider view, I mean, there are growing pains, as you said, but for a disease that we didn't know about before late 2019, the notion that we have functioning vaccines that we're putting in people's arms this soon into the game, can you talk about the historical nature of that?
Yeah, I mean, it definitely is a record time going from developing a vaccine candidate to getting shots in arms. To have all that happen within 10, 11 months is a record. What people should realize, though, is that the science behind the vaccine, you know, has been decades in the making. And actually, I'm going to put in a plug for the University of Wisconsin-Madison, the very pioneering study by John Wolfe back in 1990, published in Science, showed that you could inject a strand of RNA into a mouse and you could start getting proteins produced as a result of that injection. And the very last paragraph in that paper, he says, this could be a game changer for vaccine development. And 30 years later, look where we are.
Right. And this is a case where instead of going from 0 to 60 on a vaccine, we're going from, I don't know, 30 to 60. Once we could get the genome of the virus and that mRNA information that you were just talking about, it really lowered the time it took to get that virus, that vaccine into place, right?
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it, the 30 to 60. And the sequencing of the virus within days of the sequencing becoming available by Chinese scientists, you know, the vaccine candidates were developed.
We are talking about the COVID-19 vaccines out there, the impact they could have on the spread of the disease. Ajay Sethi is with us from the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. He's an epidemiologist. You can join in with your questions, maybe your experiences, at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. We've got Jerry with us in Muskego. Jerry, hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What did you want to tell us about, Jerry?
I recently received my vaccination at the biggest hospital in Waukesha, Wisconsin. Everybody knows who it is. And it was a complete nightmare. I tried to avoid crowds. I tried to social distance. We were herded into a hallway, two lines on a small hallway where you could just walk down the middle, shoulder to shoulder, the person behind me, the person in front of me, nose to nose. Nobody cared. We had masks, but no social distancing. I called patient relations, nothing. No return of the phone call. They don't even want to talk about it, but come on and get your shot.
Jerry, thanks for the call. So, Ajay, I think even in the vaccine lines, we want to keep up masks. And as Jerry was saying, he didn't see in this instance social distancing. The same rules apply, even if we're getting the vaccine, right?
Yeah, of course. We don't want to have crowded situations when we're vaccinating individuals. Same with COVID testing. You know, when there's long lines for COVID testing, people obviously need to be physically separated.
Thanks a lot for that call. And that reminds me, when we get that first vaccine, if we're getting that series of two, or even maybe after the second one, we don't want to rush out and throw all precaution to the wind just yet, as I understand it. Can you talk about why that is?
Yeah, so the vaccines have been proven to prevent severe disease. It will prevent people from having symptoms so severe that they require hospitalization. So those were the endpoints defined in the clinical trials, and those trials never did study how they affect transmission. And so we have to assume that there is a risk that despite being vaccinated, you can, you know, come across somebody who has the virus, potentially pick up the virus. Now, you may not experience symptoms, or if you do, it might be mild, so you can avoid hospitalization, but you may pick up that virus, and perhaps it could replicate and then be passed on to somebody else. And I think that's the main thing. Mitigation is still really important, whether people are vaccinated or not, and the science is being worked out as to how effective these vaccines are at preventing infection and transmission. We should expect some information related to that within the next few weeks or months from the manufacturers.
And thanks again for that call. And Ajay, what do we know about how long it takes from when you get that shot, even the second shot, and when it kicks in with its full protection?
Yeah, for the two vaccines that are authorized now, the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines, about 2 weeks after that second dose, you are likely to have that level of protection that's needed to prevent that severe disease.
Let's go to our callers again. Jeff is with us in northern Wisconsin. Jeff, hello.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What do you want to tell us about, Jeff?
Just that I'm a teacher up north in Wisconsin, and I feel very fortunate that the nurse at the school called me and said I had an appointment for the first shot if I wanted it. And so I went in, and then she called me again last week and said my second dose, you know, would be last Friday. So I went in, and I just wish that every school in the nation had you know, completed all their shots by now, because we have. And just wanted to give a shout-out, you know, to the school I'm at that is on the ball and fortunate, I guess, to have been able to do that. And it's been great. You know, I was fortunate not to have any effects the first shot. And the second shot, I had a little bit of, like 10 hours later, I felt that night, a little bit of flushing and a little bit of shivering. But after about an hour, I kind of felt normal again. And even one of the 85-year-old teachers I talked to today said she had zero effects after her second shot.
Wow. Jeff, thanks a lot for sharing that with us. Now, Ajay, even if we said, okay, yes, all teachers are in our current priority zone right now, there's just not the supply to get everybody, even in the categories we're trying to, that are at the top of our list, right?
Yeah, that's right. So right now, 65 years and older are sort of the priority to vaccinate. In addition to the ones prior to the 65 plus, so the frontline healthcare workers, long-term care, police, fire personnel, and teachers, educators, childcare, that's next in line. And so, yeah, around March 1st, maybe a little after when supplies start to kick in, we can get to those next groups.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Ajay Sethi, professor of population health sciences at the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health, looking at Wisconsin, how the state's doing on COVID-19 vaccinations, and what to know as we go through the process of getting the shots out there. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you gotten one or both doses of a vaccine so far, or do you have an appointment? Have you been one of the people who's had an appointment canceled because of lack of supply? And if you work anywhere along the supply chain of getting those vaccines to people in a healthcare setting, call in. Love to hear what you're seeing. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation. Take more of your calls coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk now with Ajay Sethi, epidemiologist and associate professor of population health sciences at UW-Madison, looking at trends in the state's vaccination numbers and what to know about the vaccines themselves. You can join in with your questions, maybe your experiences giving and or receiving the COVID-19 vaccines. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Go back to your calls now. Dave is with us in Madison. Dave, hello.
Hi, how you doing? Thanks for taking my call. Say, there are a lot of rumors going around, and, you know, is there any truth to this mRNA in this shot having any effect on the DNA in your cells, both in older people or younger people?
Dave, thanks for the call. This is a rumor that does fly around there, Ajay. What do we know?
Yeah, there's no effect on somebody's DNA in the cell. So the DNA is in sort of an area of the cell, sort of behind a membrane in the nucleus. The RNA gets injected into cells, begins to produce proteins, and then degrades pretty rapidly. It's a pretty fragile molecule. It's why we have to have the exceptionally cold storage, because it's so fragile. So there's no truth to the idea that the RNA in the vaccine somehow interferes with the DNA in cells.
Thanks for calling in with a question at 800-642-1234. Colton joins us next in Milwaukee. Colton, hi.
Hey, thanks for taking my question. So my question is, now we have all these different vaccines coming out, and recently the AstraZeneca one was pulled over in Europe, South Africa, because it wasn't protecting against the variant. So my question is, do you expect that with all these new variants that COVID is going to turn into this like flu-like virus where there's going to be like an annual prediction on which strain is going to become more contagious, and then there will be like an annual vaccine? And if so, will masks and social distancing be kind of indefinite then because of these new strains?
Thanks for that call. The AstraZeneca one is not one of the ones approved, at least not yet in the U.S., Ajay. But can you talk about that question? Are these viruses going to be enough of a moving target that we're going to have to keep tweaking the vaccine from month to month, maybe year to year?
Yeah, so right now we're lucky that the vaccines that are authorized for use work against these new variants. And, you know, they're in the United States, and the U.K. variant has been detected in Wisconsin. The vaccines work against those variants. The South African strain, you know, it was the Novavax vaccine that released, that manufacturer released some data to show that there was some suboptimal effects on the South African variant. It wasn't down to zero. It was just not as effective. And some of that science is still being worked out. That's why it's so important for us to indeed vaccinate as quickly as we can. And with that mitigation, prevent the spread of new variants that are in the country, in the state. And as far as updating the vaccine, certainly, especially the RNA vaccines, the technology is there to edit that sequence to keep up with the strains that are circulating and then update the vaccine. Now, we're not at that point yet, But there's certainly people who are sort of thinking about that and potentially planning for that.
Thanks a lot for that call, Colton. When it comes to being a target for vaccines, how do you compare the coronavirus with something like, as Colton mentioned, an influenza, where we've got lots of strains out there and we're trying to predict which ones are going to be coming to the United States in any given year?
Yeah, with the coronavirus, you know, this SARS-CoV-2 virus does has a different sort of evolutionary process. It kind of just slowly evolves, and then a mutant or a different strain, a variant, can emerge. With influenza, you know, there's a different process to develop new strains every year. You can get sort of tiny mutations that occur that force us to develop new vaccines every year. Every now and then, you can get a real mixing of genes between different influenza viruses, the last one being 2009 with the swine flu. That's novel. We don't expect novel influenza viruses every year, but they can certainly happen, as did recently. But both of these viruses do evolve. A lot of viruses do. And you know, as scientists, the job is to keep up with predicting what the next strain might be and making sure our vaccines are effective against them.
Let's go back to our callers. Valerie is with us, calling from Burlington. Valerie, hi.
Hi. Well, I just wanted to say I'm a clinical instructor of nursing, and I have the opportunity to take my students and have them be involved in, you know, helping put this coronavirus to rest and helping, you know, end this pandemic. And I think we all just have to remember this is brand new for not just the scientists and the doctors and everybody, but it's new for everyone. And we have to give ourselves some grace in regards to getting this vaccine out there and putting an end to this pandemic.
Valerie, thanks a lot for the call. So Valerie working with her students on this, Ajay, but saying some grace and being good together, good to each other as we go through this process might help us all a lot in the long run. What do you think?
Well, one, I want to thank Valerie for the work that she does. And there are a lot of people who are trying hard to beat this pandemic, to manage it. And everybody just needs to realize, as Valerie said, we're all on the same team. The virus is what we're all need to focus on, you know, reducing that spread and keeping ourselves healthy.
Thanks for that call. Laura joins us next in Madison. Laura, hi.
Hi. I was wondering if your guest can speak to this. In Wisconsin State Journal newspaper on Wednesday, I read that UW School of Education senior receives an injection of the vaccine, and that so far the university's administered 4,000 and so first doses and 2,000 or so second doses. As a diabetic with high blood pressure, who the state health department hasn't even decided yet whether she's going to be 1C, and in my last reading of the website from the state, university students weren't on the list. I'm at much higher risk for terrible outcomes and have lived since March 13th, haven't been out to a restaurant or a show or anything. And I'm curious if you know why university students are getting vaccinated.
Laura, thanks for the call. I haven't seen that particular story, Ajay. I know in general the priority is not for university students, but for someone at high risk like Laura, what do we know about where they are on the priority list?
Yeah, so right now, they're in the future will be vaccinated. Right now, the age is a criteria at 65 and older. And so underlying health conditions is not on the list at the moment, but it should be soon when things start opening up to the general public. When what Laura says about a university student being vaccinated, there are students, you know, who are part of frontline healthcare personnel, so that may have been the case. There's also, you know, when vaccines get thawed and are, you know, shots in arms are being delivered daily, sometimes vaccine appointments are missed and vaccinators are finding themselves potentially having to throw out doses because they have a few more doses than appointments fulfilled that day. And so some vaccinators will have sort of leftover lists and, you know, you never want to throw away a vaccine dose because those supplies are so precious. And so if somebody who you feel like isn't eligible for the vaccine is getting it, it's probably through that leftover list, because if that person doesn't get vaccinated within the next 30 minutes or hour, the vaccine is going to get tossed, and that should not happen.
Thanks for the call, and good luck to you. In our last couple of minutes, I want to look ahead at the future a little, Ajay. We've got two approved vaccines out there in the United States now. Thoughts that we might have a third and maybe a fourth before too long. What are you watching, and how much does that then impact the supply side of the equation here?
Yeah, so the Johnson & Johnson company applied for emergency use authorization from the FDA last week. And so the expert panel's reviewing those data. And on February 26th, we'll be meeting. And it's expected that this will be a third option, a third vaccine that's available. And this one's exciting because it's a single dose. It's 85% effective against severe disease, keeping people out of the hospital. And 66% effective for any symptoms, really just after one dose, which is really good. It adds to the sort of options for vaccine and will increase supply because it's a third manufacturer.
And what do you have your eye on? Just in our last 30 seconds, what are you really watching closely right now, Ajay?
Supplies increasing. The Biden-Harris administration announced yesterday that they're going to bump up from 10.1 million doses per week to 11 million. So we'll see a little bit of a rise going to states, and that's a good thing. That'll stay steady for a few weeks. And then we're hoping with Johnson & Johnson coming online and hopefully Pfizer and Moderna supplying more vaccine to the federal government and the community vaccination site and Walgreens kicking in through a separate program, 18,000 doses per week, that we can see a little bit more expansion in the weeks to come.
Ajay, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thank you, Rob.
Ajay Sethi is an associate professor of population health sciences at the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. He was with us to talk about what's behind an improvement in Wisconsin's vaccination numbers and what to know as we go through the vaccination process. Coming up, Tom Brady just won his 7th Super Bowl, and at advanced age, by NFL standards, we'll see what we can learn from him about age and success. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. The average age of an NFL player is 26, with an average retirement age of 35. Tom Brady is still going strong at age 43. He just won his 7th Super Bowl in his first year as quarterback for the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. He was also named Super Bowl MVP for the 5th time. He was asked whether he'd return for a potential 8th Lombardi Trophy.
I'm coming back. You better believe I'm coming back.
So how does he do it? And more importantly, how can we do it? Not win a Super Bowl, of course. I think that ship has sailed for me. But have big success in other areas of life as we grow older. Colin Fleming is a writer whose work has appeared in publications including The Atlantic, Sports Illustrated, Rolling Stone, and others. He's the author of the book Meatheads Say the Realest Things, a satirical short novel of the last bro. And he wrote a piece in USA Today about what we can learn from Brady about aging. Colin, thanks a lot for joining us today.
I appreciate you having me on.
Well, first, you're from Boston. I understand a big New England Patriots fan. How did it feel watching your old guy win one with the wrong team?
I think I was less conflicted and angst-ridden than a lot of people in the area because of the novelty of greatness, which I think is more novel than ever. And I'm interested in seeing how far someone can take their ability, which they couple with their work ethic, in a society that I feel is largely anti-meritocracy, save in the arena of sports. So the same way I'd listen to Beethoven at the end of his composing career was sort of how I was intrigued by what Brady was doing.
And then you, in this piece I mentioned, USA Today, you went looking for lessons for the rest of us, basically on not giving up on stuff as we age. What kind of things were you thinking about there?
Well, that almost makes it sound like we're octogenarians sitting around and we need our daily constitutional type of thing. What I really am talking about is this notion of prematurely considering ourselves spavined, like we're 40 or we're 50 or we're 60 or whatever it is. And I feel like we try to cut these corners now where we don't put ourselves out there with as much purpose, and there's comfort in the dad bod, for instance. And you see it too, like during the era of COVID, with everyone with their memes about I stay home, I save lives. Well, the bag of Doritos on the couch isn't really comparable with taking out the sniper up in the bell tower. And I think we find a way to cut corners for ourselves.
So as you look at Tom Brady, what does that inspire you to do, for example, to not cut corners? I'm not sure how old you are, actually, but whatever your age, how does it inspire you to not cut corners?
It doesn't really inspire me because I feel like it's something that I already try to do, which can put me at odds with how a lot of people live. I was sort of given the idea for this piece when this ex-girlfriend contacted me, and she was someone I knew in college, and she was talking about, oh, we're so old now. I'm thinking, like, I just walked 20 miles today and wrote 4,000 words and ran 3,000 stairs. And it occurred to me that so much of it was how she chose to look at something and how I was looking at something. But the math doesn't compute. If you're 40 or you're 50 and you're old then, what are you when you hit 91? I mean, Paul McCartney was born in what, 1943? And if it weren't for this virus, he'd be out doing his thing in Milwaukee or wherever. So it's just to seem at odds with logic to me for a long time.
Part of what you write about is not giving up on experiencing new things. It might be new music or other experiences, not saying, I've already discovered what I'm going to discover. Why is that an important mindset?
Well, there's a lot of that. And you see it now when people have these kind of Netflix binges where they're in quarantine and they're digging into whatever show that everyone else is already digging into. But you never really hear someone say, I had some time off, so I was reading the novels of Dickens or Proust or learning what Buster Keaton was all about. And I think when we fail to do that, to extend our parameters daily, we're undercutting some of our own humanness, and we're becoming sort of these pod people where we have the exact same five or six interests, which aren't real interests. And we speak in almost like meme speak in the same at the end of the day type of cliches. And it's hard to be an individual. And Brady has certainly been an individual in how he chooses to go about what ought to have been a truncated football career if we're to factor in how it goes for everyone else, like with those numbers you cited.
What kind of things do you recommend people do if they feel like, hey, wait, you know, maybe I am caught in that mindset. I've picked my age and let that be an excuse for keeping me from doing cool new stuff.
I'd say that people need to dispense with comparing themselves to others and to compare themselves to themselves and to who they wish to be. Because if you're always playing this game of compare and contrast, you're always going to find it out. You're going to be enabled by other people's indolence to stay in on that day when it's 25 degrees and you could be walking the 5 miles and detuning from the world and just having your own thoughts. So I would say that you have to look within and stop looking to what people are doing on Facebook and all of that kind of rubbish.
Oh, I wish it could be 25 degrees. That sounds pretty warm right about now. But I think we can also look at people like maybe Tom Brady and say, well, I'm never going to be a Super Bowl quarterback, so why go out and throw a football around now? How about the motivation to do something, even if we know we're not going to be great at it, but it's still worth doing in and of itself?
I think there is, like you mentioned, there's a difference between greatness and efficacy. And we can opt for the latter oftentimes. It's almost like intelligence. I feel like sometimes it comes down to us to choose to be intelligent. Like you're born with what you're born with, but you can coach yourself up, as it were, and put time in. The people don't put time in. And I think if you do that, you set goals, and I'm going to do this at the board meeting, or I'm going to do this in the email chain as we're getting ready to figure out who our guests are going to be that day and what we're going to talk about in the radio program, that everyone can sort of transport that Brady gridiron to their own purview.
And Colin, as we wrap up, you're going to be a Bucs fan next year with Brady still at the helm?
I wasn't a Bucks fan this year, and I was chagrined with the way things went here in New England. I didn't really enjoy that whatsoever, but I don't know. It's not that often that we get to witness something that's or someone doing something truly great in this world. And I don't know how you can actively, well, I guess if you're a Packers fan,
yeah, I was going to say
root against that.
Yeah, I was kind of rooting against it, but I had my personal reasons. Colin, thanks a lot for joining us today.
All right. Thanks for having me.
Colin Fleming is a writer and author of the book Meatheads Say the Realest Things, a satirical short novel of the last bro. Talk to him about what we can learn about aging from Tom Brady, who just won his 7th Super Bowl at age 43, old in football terms, and plans to play again next season. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. This month marks the program's 10th anniversary. As part of the celebration, here's former host Erica Janik reflecting on one of her favorite stories that centered on friendship and adult literacy.
Hello, Wisconsin! There are so many stories that I could have picked, so many that have stuck with me and introduced me to people from all over the state. It was a true blessing to host and produce this show. Now, we did many different series, but one of them that I was most proud of was a series on literacy in Wisconsin. I visited with people all over the state who were kind enough and honestly brave enough to share their stories with me, because being an adult who struggles with literacy isn't something that many people feel comfortable talking about or sharing. And one of the people I met was a woman named Ruth, who was working with her tutor, Bonnie. They met once a week at the Oshkosh Public Library, which is where I met them.
I was recently retired and decided I needed to do something constructive with my time. And I saw in the paper where they were needing volunteers. So I contacted them. I went through the training that you need to go through. I remember I still have the email that Danielle sent me and said, I have a learner for you that I think you would like to work with, and her name is Ruth.
First, when I got here, I had problems of reading, understanding the questions. That person said, well, I know some people up here that could help you with it. So I came up here.
Ruth is my first person that I tutored with, and I think Ruth was working towards her GED initially. That's what brought her to those services, and we've been together since that time.
We read every Wednesday.
Every Wednesday for about an hour.
Sometimes she will help me go over words and solving it out. Because I do have some big words right now that I got a book I'm reading.
But she does really well. We're working on breaking them apart, sounding them out. Ruth is not a child, so I'm not going to teach Ruth like a child. Ruth is very committed to this. She never misses, and she has made such huge progress this last year. It's amazing. The Ruth that I first met was not this Ruth. You were very quiet, and you did not make eye contact. You didn't smile, and now it's like she's just gotten that self-confidence, and she shines when she's here.
I never had people do this before. I usually try to depend on myself, and I love working with her. She's a very sweet lady, but she's been doing a lot of things for me that I don't expect her to do. I mean, she's like my sister, but she's not. She's goes out for me, and I love her for that. I mean, she's a great lady.
Don't make me cry, Ruth. Don't make me cry this morning.
Yeah, well, I'm sorry. It's the truth. I mean, I'd go out and jump for celebration if I passed the test. You did it. Now go out there and buy screen the whole world. I did it. That would make me feel so happy and proud. That's my goal right now.
We'll work on that then.
Wisconsin Life means the world to me, and it's a pleasure to share this story with you. My greatest hope for the show is that you would hear people who sound like you and people you didn't know lived in Wisconsin. Wisconsin Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Erica Janik.
Hear more Wisconsin Life stories all month that celebrate the program's 10-year history on Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up, we'll talk to a reporter about a year of protest and controversy around the Wauwatosa Police Department and what it means as the city starts the process of hiring a new police chief. That's coming up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Tonight at 6 on 1A+, it's this week's edition of the 1A Movie Club. That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now, Wauwatosa Police Chief Barry Weber announced his retirement earlier this month. He spent 48 years in law enforcement, including 30 in Wauwatosa. Over the last year, the city saw protests aimed at the department and former officer Joseph Mensa, who was cleared of wrongdoing in the February shooting of 17-year-old Alvin Cole. New reporting shows that during the demonstrations that went on, the department created a list of Black Lives Matter protesters to surveil, and one internal presentation identified the city's mayor, Dennis McBride, as a, quote, higher value target. Joseph Mensa has since been hired by the Waukesha County Sheriff's Department, and the Wauwatosa Police and Fire Commission plans to hire a new chief to take the post this June. Isaiah Holmes is a reporter for the Wisconsin Examiner who's been covering the Wauwatosa Police Department and the protests. Isaiah, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it's been a turbulent year around the country when it comes to police and race relations. Can you give us kind of the timeline of how it all played out in Wauwatosa over the last year, kind of the basics?
Yeah, sure. So shortly after the killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis, protesters in Milwaukee took to the streets on May 29th, 2020. And it took a couple weeks for those kinds of protests to kind of focus and make their way to Wauwatosa and hone in on those issues, which they did in about mid June. From there, protesters just continued to just march the streets, pound the pavement, and bring attention to the killing of Alvin Cole and also the other two shootings involving Joseph Mensa. And over time, I guess, they all began to gradually learn more about the Wauwatosa Police Department, and it became a push against the entire movement in Tosa kind of grew bigger than the Mensa issue over time.
Yeah, what kind of things did they start to raise as issues apart from Officer Mensa himself?
Well, for one, over time, the Wauwatosa Police Department's tactics against the protesters became more restrictive and became more aggressive, and not just the Wauwatosa Police Department, the city of Wauwatosa instituted more than one curfew. There was a curfew in August, there are just these continued tactics to try to disrupt the protests. In terms of Wauwatosa Police Department, things like deploying spike strips to impede the car caravans, arresting individual protesters almost at random at times, kettling in the protesters and preventing them from really marching on. And those were just the more overt tactics. That's not including the monitoring. Tosa officers taking pictures of protesters, taking pictures of journalists, ACLU. And over time, these kinds of tactics became very regular.
And you've been issuing public records requests to the department for a variety of documents. One thing you found, this was last month, I think, an internal PowerPoint that listed the mayor of Wauwatosa, Dennis McBride, as a, quote, higher value target. Can you talk about the context that was in and what came from that?
Yeah, sure. So like you said, that was revealed through open records requests that I had filed with the Wauwatosa Police Department. And essentially what this was an investigative PowerPoint, which was created by Wauwatosa detectives and emailed by a member of the Wauwatosa Special Operations Group, which is essentially this tight-knit group of detectives that do very specialized work within the department. And the investigative PowerPoint pertained to an incident which occurred at Officer Mensa's house in August, where protesters went to the house, and there was a confrontation between Officer Mensa and some of the people who were there, and a weapon fired by, or weapon owned by, one of the protesters was fired, and three protesters were arrested in the days after that. So that's essentially what this PowerPoint was about. It was an update into that investigation, and it identified a few high-value targets. Among them was Dennis McBride, the mayor of Wauwatosa, and he was identified for allegedly sanctioning violence against Mensa. His PowerPoint mentioned the public listening sessions that the city had held, allowing people to vent their concerns about racial profiling and discrimination. It had also mentioned his meetings with several members of the community, including lawyer Kimberly Motley, who represents the families that Mensa killed, the families whose loved ones were killed by Mensa. And it essentially weaved this kind of picture of them essentially trying to accumulate evidence against the mayor, and the PowerPoint concluded with no probable cause in Mensa shooting ... yet. So that was essentially the context of that PowerPoint.
Talking to Isaiah Holmes, reporter with the Wisconsin Examiner, looking at the police department and protests in Wauwatosa over the last year. Well, now we have the police chief there retiring after a long career, and obviously a new job opening, a hiring process going on scheduled for this summer at a strange time, a difficult time to make a change like that. What kind of things are you watching for in that process?
For one, I'll be looking at what the actual procedure of finding a new chief is, and what those candidates are, and how transparent that process is. Chief Barry Weber has been the chief of Wauwatosa for about 30 years. Throughout that time, the police department's practices in terms of racial profiling and other things like that had always been in question. Looking out for, you know, reformative policies and also seeing if any loose ends were tied up by the time the chief leaves. There's still the internal investigation regarding the mayor's PowerPoint, which is, we still have to see a conclusion to that. The mayor said that there is very likely that officers involved in making that PowerPoint would be disciplined. But even that being said, just a couple weeks after the protests began back in the summer, the Wauwatosa Police Department created a list of protesters and a protester list over a month before that incident at Officer Mensa's, and also even before Mensa was suspended after pressure from the protests back in the summer. So Chief Weber, although he says he wasn't aware of the PowerPoint, was CC'd in the emails discussing the protest folder and the protest list. So moving forward, a lot of people in a Wauwatosa community groups, et cetera, are really concerned about wanting to move the police department in a different, you know, reformative direction, which polices in a way which is not targeting people, singling people out, sometimes on a personal basis or a political basis, but also just moving just the Wauwatosa Police Department forward in a more progressive manner.
And by the end of the last year, a lot of protests around the country had tapered off to a large extent. Have you seen much protest activity over the winter, it publicly or in other ways?
Yeah, and not just in Wauwatosa, but in Milwaukee, particularly the People's Revolution protesters, they do an action every single day, whether that's building a snow fist around the city or holding a Zoom meeting to try to figure out how they can get more people engaged to actually march in the streets in sub-zero temperatures. These things go on every single day, and they can be found through social media. So protesters are definitely keeping up the momentum going into the spring and the summer, which will be, of course, when the one-year anniversary of the protests will happen. So we'll see what happens then.
Isaiah, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Isaiah Holmes is a reporter with the Wisconsin Examiner. He joined us for a look at the Wauwatosa Police Department's approach to Black Lives Matter protesters over the last year and a change in police chief on the way. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 8, take a look back on the 10th anniversary of Act 10, the law that limits public employee unions in Wisconsin. Kate talks to members of public employee unions and to former Governor Scott Walker. That's tomorrow at 8 on the morning show. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then it's the week in Washington. We'll look at several top national political stories, including today's second day of the second impeachment trial of former President Trump. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.